chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our friend John Hart has been the winner of two Edgar Awards for the Best Mystery Novel of the Year. He's now right in the middle of launching his fourth book called Iron House. We've talked to him about the book before, but we haven't talked to him about the excitement and the challenges that are going on right now during the first couple of weeks after the launch of the book. And John Hart, you're on the road in Charleston, South Carolina, but you've agreed to take a minute or two to visit with your friends in Chapel Hill and share a little bit of the experience of launching your fourth book, which is destined, I think, to become another bestseller and award winner.
Well, I hope you're right on that, DG. I'm always happy to be talking with you. Thanks for having me.
The fact that you, with the two of your first three books, won Edgar Awards, and many of your colleagues in the mystery or thriller writing community, I mean, if they just get a nomination for an Edgar Award, they feel like they've hung the moon. Well, I mean, are your colleagues walking around with little secret knives in their back? There's a little bit of reverse Schadenfreude that they're real happy for you, but they just can't believe this.
I haven't seen that in any overt form. Nobody's painted a target on my back. No one said a cruel word. It was kind of funny, though, when The Last Child won the Edgar. I guess we had been nominated three times and won once at that stage. And it was sort of the big joke of the Edgar's banquet is, God, you know, what are we going to do if John Hart wins another one? I mean, I think the MC was even making jokes about it. So it was pretty remarkable when it actually happened.
Well, you when you visited us before, you showed us the actual Edgar Awards, and the Edgar Awards is not like an Oscar. It's like an Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bust of Edgar Allan Poe, and the awards go back 65 years now, and they're one, if not the oldest, literary award in the country. And I mean, it's a great, great thing if you write commercial fiction, but the awards themselves are horribly unattractive. I mean, I something tells me Edgar Allan Poe was not the most attractive man in life, and being rendered in alabaster has not improved him. But it's a wonderful piece of art to own, regardless.
Well, you keep on going. Maybe they'll name an award after you, and you can see how you look in crematics.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to hold my breath on that one.
The other thing that has interested me as I've followed the launch of your book is that I went to your website, went to other websites, and I found a wonderful selection from North Carolina Book Watch on your describing your characters, and I was just thrilled that you and your publicist had used our video to be a part of your book. I mean, so we're known all over the country thanks to you.
Oh well, that was wonderful. It was very kind of you guys to share that video. The publishers are pushing this book very, very hard, and publishers are a creative bunch. And they're always looking for good ways to get the word out, to let people know about the book in some interesting and entertaining way. And being able to take, I don't know how long the clip is, 2 or 3 minutes or four, whatever they took from your show was wonderful. And obviously you can see it on Amazon and BNN.com and, of course, on my website.
Well, thank you for making me famous.
Well, I wish that there was more, but I guess they felt that was the right amount to air. Now, as soon as your Book Watch program is available online, I'll link to it as well.
It is. I think it is available online.
Oh,
and we'll link it. We'll link that. Thanks for reminding me. We'll link that on the WCH or what is the Chapel Hill, the chapelboro.com website here for folks who'd like to see the complete television interview with John Hart about his new book, Iron House. John, talk to us a little bit. I get excited. And again, a little bit envious. I admit there's a little bit of envy going on here. But talk to us about what your publisher's doing and what you're doing to launch Iron House, your fourth book. It came out, I think, on the about the 12th of July. So it's brand new, and some of that tidal wave of publicity and promotion we haven't seen yet. I mean, some of it, it's not just a one cannon shot kind of thing that most publishers give most books.
No, I mean, publishing is as much about what they call the long tail as it is about the roar out of the gate. And so we're trying to maximize both things. I can say that after the first week, comparing Iron House to The Last Child, we're up about 3.5 times in terms of sales, which has just been remarkable.
Can you talk about numbers?
No, that's like asking me how much money I make, DG. The numbers are good.
The numbers are good, but I mean, I don't know whether that's 20 books or 20,000 books.
It's many thousands of books.
And you're smiling.
I'm smiling. I'm very happy. I mean, and it's because of the relative nature of things. It's a tough time for books. It's a down economy, and that affects everything. And to be not just flat or slightly up, but up 3.5 times in this market is exceptional. And so clearly the publishers have done something right. The market seems to be responding well to the book. It's satisfying.
Well, based on the experience with your other three books, is the roughly speaking, just rough and ready, how much of the sales of the book is going to be compacted into that the first 6 weeks or 2 months of the, are 50% of the books or 75% of the books going to be sold during that rush period when it first comes out?
Yes, and that really is the, that's sort of the holy grail that publishers try to achieve, and it's what I refer to as the long tail, and it's somehow avoiding this fate of selling half the books in the first 3 weeks and then struggling to keep the momentum. The Last Child, for instance, and this is more about its second incarnation in trade paperback, spent over 6 months on the New York Times bestseller list, and that was really wonderful because it just kept going and going, and even now we're selling between 2,000 and 3,000 copies a week, and that book's been out for 2.5 years. So that's really exciting.
That is not just exciting, that's incredible. That's atypical, I guess, of a book.
So. Yeah, and what's really nice is that the entire backlist is surging.
In paperback, primarily.
Trade paperback.
And trade paperback is where it goes after hardback.
Right.
But right now, with the new book, Iron House, you're in hardback.
Yeah.
And this is the big money maker for the publisher, and so they want to really sell a lot right now.
Yeah, and we've been lucky in that we've already been back to print twice, which is very encouraging.
Well, now, John, all right, now, okay, you won't tell me numbers, but I can figure, and that is that you've been back to print twice, and you started out, or at least they promised you were going to start out with 75,000 copies.
No, the announced first printing was 200,000 copies.
200,000 copies.
Yeah. You're thinking of King of Lies, I think.
Well, my memory, I didn't write this down because this wasn't exactly what I planned to talk to you about, but I'm so excited. 200,000 copies of Iron House, which my friends would be happy to have a lifetime sale of 200,000 of all of their books. I mean, this is an incredible amount first printing. And I said, oh my gosh, what if they get stuck? Whatever number I was thinking about in thousands, what if they get stuck with a whole bunch of those books?
Well, it happens all the time. I mean, publishers try to walk this line between getting large quantities in the marketplace, but not any more than they're liable to sell. And so you want to see them stacked up and you want to see them here and there. But you don't want to come, you don't want 100,000 copies coming back. We've been lucky in so many things. One of them is, of course, the fact that the book was chosen by independent booksellers as their number one pick for the month of August. And so I think there are about 2,000 independent bookstores in this country, and their mandate really is to sell Iron House.
Well, you printed 200,000. They're distributed throughout bookstores, so theoretically, it's possible that they could be returned.
Of course.
But based on the earliest sales figures and the enthusiasm that you got from booksellers, the publisher has already gone back to the printing press to send out more copies.
That's correct. Yes.
Like. Thousands of more, hundreds of thousands of more.
Well, I wouldn't say hundreds of thousands more, but what you want to see is, 12 printings, 15 printings. And those printings might be 5,000 copies more, or it might be 20,000 copies more. But you want that slow burn.
You want the printing press running every week.
Right. And one of the things publishers do is it's fairly easy to reprint books. It's the jackets that are difficult. Jackets are expensive to set up. They're expensive to manufacture. And so Right now, for instance, I think we have about 6,000 or 7,000 copies of Iron House in inventory, but we have 25,000 jackets in inventory, which means they can go back to print very quickly on another 20,000 books and have the jackets ready and waiting.
So they're willing on, or some businessman says, okay, if we're going to print the jackets, we better go ahead and print a whole bunch of them because it's so expensive to run short runs of these jackets and takes time. Let's just get a whole bunch of them printed, and we'll probably need them. But even if we don't, we won't have invested in the book, in the little bit more expensive thing of the book printing.
And it's much easier to warehouse 20,000 jackets than it is 20,000 books.
All of these things you've learned that we never thought you'd be interested in.
Seriously, that I would never have the slightest interest in, but it's a fascinating business. And I admire publishers so much because they're doing something very difficult when you think about it. They're trying to sell mass quantities of objects or products that are unique. I mean, every book is obviously different, and there's so much subjective value in that. You can't look at it like it's a widget and say, well, the market needs this many widgets in the following month. I mean, it's really about the public appetite, and that's tricky.
We're visiting with John Hart, the author of his fourth novel, now based on what he's told us, destined to be reported in the next week or two as a New York Times bestseller book. And we're talking about the business of publishing, the business of being an author, and he and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. John Hart is my guest. John is the author of Iron House. That's his fourth novel. Two of the three earlier books won the Edgar Award as the best mystery novel in of the year. And John, it looks like Iron House. You're not surprised because you have always said this is your best book yet. But you never know. But you're off the ground and flying. I mean, it's a success, right?
It's an unqualified success. It's interesting. Publishers can tell in the first week if a book is going to fail.
How do they know?
Well, I mean, it's a numbers game. I mean, they get daily tracking numbers from all the major outlets, and they know how many they've printed, and they have a general sense of what a sales cycle can look like. And it's an interesting study because while they can tell in the first week if a book is going to fail, and by that I mean if a book starts off on a downward slope, it's almost impossible to recover.
How would it, in a week? I mean, but in a week, that first launch week, it's hardly even started. I mean, there's not a lot of chatter from people who've read the book yet. I mean, how do they know so quick?
Well, look, to finish my first thought, and then I'll come back to that.
Okay.
What they don't know at the end of the first week, they can tell if a book is failing, but if a book is in fact succeeding, they don't know how well it will succeed. If the book works in that first week, the door is open for exponential growth or flat, long, steady sales or a slow, gradual decline. They don't know exactly what will happen, but if it's not working, that is writ large. And the reason for that, the power of that first week, is because if you think about it, all of the marketing and advertising, all the dollars being spent to make the book a success are front-end loaded. And a lot of that is about pre-orders. So if they've been talking up a book and getting word out and sending advanced readers copies and doing all of these things that they do, and the pre-orders, meaning Amazon, BNN.com, et cetera, if they're not happening, you know on day one. And furthermore, if the, you know, I had a full-page color ad in the New York Times the day the book came out, which was wonderful. If that doesn't relate to sales inside the first week, they're pretty certain that nothing else will, because that's about as big an ad buy as you can make, except for perhaps television. So if all of these things are done and the publisher has committed to the book and they've done their job and yet that first sales week disappoints, it's obvious and it hurts and everybody knows that they're not going to throw good money after bad. Now, where we are, which is, I mean, you really want to know what that first week looks like because that will tell you so much. As I said earlier, we're up about 3.5 times over the same period with The Last Child. So the publishers see this as a win, and then the question becomes, how long can we make this a win? How much resources will be allocated to driving this book even further and faster. And so those discussions are being held as we speak.
So what, in other words, first week, the big push with the all the publicity and the both free and paid publicity, and if it seems like that's working, then the publisher says we got something good. It'll do better if we really push it hard. I mean, it might sustain itself, but if we invest some money in it, we can make it even better. And so your publishers are now scratching their heads and saying, what big money can, this is a big money project, what big money can we spend to make it even bigger? That's sort of their discussions. And who's talking about this? And are you a part of those conversations?
Oh, I'm a part of those conversations, absolutely. The conversations are being held at the highest level of the house, meaning it's, you know, the publisher and president, and of course my editor and the director of marketing, the director of sales, the ad director. I mean, everybody that is committed to making the book a success is involved. It'll be a big group discussion. My agent, of course, will be involved. And our job, meaning myself and the agent, is to convince the publishers to spend more money and to print more books.
So you're an advocate of saying, looks like this is great. We have to remind you. Now, on the other hand, I was just thinking the other direction, that your publisher is sending you flowers or chocolates or whatever, or women or whatever it is that you like, that they're saying, hey, one of the things we got to do is keep this author happy and make him excited. Are they calling you and saying, John, man, this is great. We're so happy. Thank you. Thank you. Or is that just part of the business?
You can tell a writer's relative worth to their house based on the level of access. At 7:45 this morning, I was on the phone with the publisher himself, the big guy. And, you know, that's not a call that you get if you're selling 3,000 copies.
Who's the big guy at your publisher?
The big guy at my publisher, they're actually, they're two. There's one whose name is Matthew Shear, and he is the co-publisher of the hardcover division and also the publisher of the paperback division.
Now, this is St. Martin's.
St. Martin's, yeah.
Now, there's what part is Thomas Dunn Books is, what that's also...
Thomas Dunn Books is an imprint of St. Martin's, and there's another publisher there. His name is Thomas Dunn, and he's obviously integral to this. And then there's the president of the house herself. There's a woman named Sally Richardson, and she's also the co-publisher of the hardcover and the president of the house. So all three of those are really a triumvirate of big decision makers. And I really speak through Matthew more than anyone else. But they're all involved.
Well, John, one of the things, you know, we're watching the Murdoch saga, I guess is the right word to use, in which Mr. Murdoch has so many great. He's in the publishing business, in the news business. There's some relationship. It's a different kind of publishing business. But the other day, when he was appearing before the Parliament, he talked about his paper, News World, just being 1% of his whole publishing empire. And so I'm thinking, here's where I'm going with this thought, that your publishing group are looking at Iron House, and they're thinking, this is a big part of our revenue picture for this year.
Oh, yeah.
This is more than 1%. I mean, if this thing really, this could make money for our shareholders, right? I mean, this could either be just another book where we maybe make a small profit, or this could be gangbusters for us.
Yeah, and no one really knows. I mean, you know, if it is one of these books that goes back to print 12 or 15 times, great. Regardless, it's in the win column. It is funny, though. I think I am actually a line item in the publisher's budget.
Are you?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think I am. I think that was my editor's term about a year ago.
He said we're a line item.
Yeah.
So the people who are taking the owners and the managers are looking at you to see whether or not you outperformed what your budget was.
Well, and they want to know. The question every year is: are we going to have a hard book this year? And you know, how does that factor into our projections? And and that's great. And the important thing to remember, though, is that if publishing works, if a novel works, it really is a team effort. I mean, I have to do my job, which is to deliver the right book, and they have to do their job, which is to publish it well. And inherent in that is a fundamental trust, because this is a forward-looking business. It's a long-term relationship business. They need to know that I can produce dependable product for the use of a commercial term, and I need to know that they can carry the load and get this book out there and sell a lot of them. Otherwise, I need to be talking to another publisher. And that's an ongoing thing, and I'm blessed in that I really and truly like my publishers.
So when you're having these conversations during this really heady first couple of weeks after publication, and you and your agent you all are part of the team with the publisher. You all have the same objective of selling more books. But right now, it's in your interest to sell, to push them to sell even, to work harder to sell books. And an ingredient of that conversation is, look, guys, I love you. But we're at a moment where I can not just be rich, I can be super rich if we can maximize the sale of these books. You guys don't stop promoting me.
Yeah, and it's totally understood that we're all watching to see if we're going to be in bed together for the long term. We get calls pretty regularly from heads of other houses asking, is John happy where he is? Is John happy where he is on the list, meaning the bestseller list? We can do better.
How do they make? That would be a delicate sales pitch to make, because when you're trying to steal an author from another publisher, like hiring somebody, like making any other hire of somebody, you want to be careful not to run down your competition in a way that gets around that you're that you're dirty or anything like that, but. What do they say to you that might tempt you to change publishers?
Well, it all goes through my agent, of course, and I have not had those conversations. These are conversations being directed towards my agent, and frankly, while publishing is a civil and gentlemanly affair, I believe it's still that way. It's also a pretty cold, hard business, and I don't think those conversations are delicate. I think they call my agent and say, "Hey, is John happy? If not, we think we can do better, and we can sell more books, and we can put them higher on the list." And so it's
how do they say that they can? Is that just a sales pitch, or can some people prove that they?
It's a little bit of both. It's certainly a sales pitch, but there are numbers that are very easy to find. What house has the highest number of bestsellers? Who has the most number one hits? Who has taken young talent and made them a household name? Those are the claims that are made. We did this for, and I'm just picking a name out of the air, but we did this for David Baldacci. We can do it for you. So those claims are easy to find and easy to come by, and they're easy to verify as well. But at the end of the day, I think it's important for the success to belong to everybody, because it keeps everyone invested. For instance, I've been with the same house from the first day, when no one had ever heard of John Hart, and my success is their success, and this is something we've achieved together, and that gives an ownership to the management of that company, the decision makers of that company, that someone else wouldn't have if they just paid me more money.
There's a history, isn't there? This is a question, not a fact, but there is a history, isn't there, of disappointments that have come from authors who've maybe precipitously changed publishers, tempted by either a personality or by more money or by something, that they've lost the sort of family that they grew up with, and they found that there wasn't the family promised.
Yeah.
In the second marriage kind of thing.
Grass is always greener, and that's a dangerous, seductive thing. And the way I look at it, DG, is that my publishers now, let's say book five stumbles and it's not as good, they're going to stick with me because we're in this together. If it was just a financial arrangement, if they had just bought me, so to speak, from another house, they might decide, well, that was a bad investment, and turn to some other author. So there is that incentive, I think, to keep a working team together when the team is in fact working. But look, it's a big world out there, and people throw big numbers around, and it's interesting.
Well, it's exciting. We're visiting with John Hart. John Hart is the author of a fourth bestseller book called Iron House that's just come out. He's giving us a little inside look at what it's like to be a successful author, and he and I will be right back after this short break.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. John Hart is my guest. You've been reading about him because his book Iron House is getting a lot of attention. It's a bestseller. It's getting both paid and free publicity, and it's, as John says, it's off to a success that is 3.5 times greater than his very successful third book, The Last Child. So, John, this is an exciting time. I want to talk, you and I have talked about the book, both on North Carolina Book Watch on UNC-TV and an earlier edition of Who's Talking, but there are some interesting aspects to your book that I wonder, I mean, the question sort of is, what have you learned about your book from talking to people who read it or who read about it that you didn't know before? And one of, and it's in the context of this hero that you developed for Iron House, who is, who's a cold-blooded killer. And you have said that your challenge in this book was to how to frame him, how to make him such a person that even though he could kill without thinking about it, that your readers would come to identify with him and pull for him. And did you succeed in this task?
Oh, I think I did. And I'll tell you up front, I knew when I decided to write this character that, A, he would be very different. I mean, this is a man capable of great violence, but he's also more than that. And I knew that I was running this risk. I will lose some fans. The first three books were not about violence on the page. They were about the aftermath of violence. And I had to be willing to walk through the shadows, basically, to bring this character down the road that I'd put him on, meaning I couldn't shy away from the things that come if you're writing about the life of a professional killer. And so, you know, there is a lot of stuff on the page. I mean, the book's ultimately about more than that. It's about turning the page and choosing to be different than what he's become. But yeah, there are some hard things in this book, and I've heard from people that you know, they don't much care for it.
So you feel like you've lost some fans?
Well, the plan was to risk losing a few for the opportunity to gain a multitude. And this is far and away the most commercial endeavor I've ever done. And by that, I mean simply that it's the most propulsive. I think the Charlotte Observer called it John Hart 2.0. everything's faster and more powerful. And so there is, I think, a tremendous market for this kind of book. I honestly do believe, DJ, that there's nothing gratuitous in this book. I mean, it's not a shock value piece. That's not what it's about at all. But it's a really cold, hard examination of what happens when someone who's done many, many bad things tries to change his life, and the bad things tend to follow. And so you do see some of that.
Well, is the risk with your the risk that you would lose some fans based on, is it based on the fact that some of your fans were both wanted both the thriller mystery and also the literary fiction part of it, and no gratuitous violence, and you've got a little bit, you've moved a little bit in the other direction, so these people drop off? Is that?
Well, I don't think I'm going to disappoint the folks that like thrillers mixed with a certain literary quality, and I always cringe when I use that word literary because I think that it's full of hoity-toity.
Well, I'm sorry, I use that, and I'm a little hoity-toity.
No, it's okay. I mean, it is what it is, and it says something. And what it says is that there's more to this book than just the plot, and I think that's wonderful. And so, no, I've not walked away from those principles, and I don't think that readers will be disappointed there. It's just that the first three books were very much about normal people trying to find the strength to deal with these terrible circumstances and come through it and be whole or close to whole by the end of the book. And this is a book about a man with a skill set. It's a book about a man who's capable and who doesn't need to find strength. He just needs to find direction. And so it's a little bit different because it's not so much about normal people. It's about a man that is more than normal
and
less than normal. Depending on how you
look at it. Yeah, but I mean, he's a cold-blooded killer, and
your
reader has to somehow come to terms with that. Well, now you're out on the I call it the campaign trail, but you're on the book tour right now. And tell us about the book tour. Where have you been, and what have you learned from the people from your fans who come to hear you talk about it?
Well, it's going to be a 6-week tour, a month or so domestic, and then the last 2 weeks in Australia and New Zealand, which is going to be really awesome, I think. And I've been in the Carolinas since the book came out. I'm in Charleston now, and was in North Carolina until very recently. And tomorrow I'm off to other ports of call, Nashville and New York and Florida, Houston and Denver and some other places. What I've found on this tour, and I think this is as much simply a matter of just the way writing careers move and change, is that I've had much larger turnouts than what I've had before. I mean, by a pretty significant factor. There are a lot of people out there now who have read more than one of my books.
Are you talking about tens or 20s or hundreds of people?
Hundreds for sure. I mean, I did. I spoke to about 150 people yesterday at a luncheon. We had almost 500 people come out in Salisbury. Well over 150 in Greensboro. Well over 100 in Charlotte. Trying to think, we did Raleigh. I got to the Raleigh. This is great. This is the sound you want to hear when you're on tour. I got to the Raleigh event a little bit early and was back in sort of the sequestering room, and all I could hear coming from the other room was the sound of the manager opening more chairs. I mean, he pulled out every chair he had in storage. I mean, for half an hour he was just bringing out folded chairs. That's a really.
I never heard that before. That's the greatest sound an author can. Here is the sound of folding chairs being unfolded.
It's the exact opposite of the sound of crickets. this is my homeland. I mean, these are the Carolinas, and the challenge and interesting part will be what happens when I get further afield. But at the end of the day, it's a good turnout, even if it's a small number, because there are people that are willing to come out and see what you do. Obviously, I like it when they're standing room only.
Well, John, what can you tell about your fan base, both in terms of your travel plans for promoting the book, and also whether or not your publisher can give you, whether or not there are figures that give you an idea about where your geographic fan base is and how widespread it is across the country and across the world?
Well, there's a lot of information out there. I've been a London Times bestseller in England for the past two books. So I'm doing really well there and in their territory, former colonial territories like Australia, uh-huh. South Africa, India, and all those places. Inside the continental United States, I mean, I will always do best in the Southeast, but New York is a massive market for me. I sell a huge number of books in the New York area and in the major metropolitan areas going out west. I always will feel like I have room to grow on the West Coast. I'm not even come close to tapping that market. So I would like to see more of that. Otherwise, it's anybody's guess. I mean, I think that the publishers can probably drill down. I've never really cared enough to say, give me a breakout of where it's working. I just know that, I'm a Southern writer in my heart, and I think the South relates to that. And so what is interesting about my books, and I think that there are many theories that I would put forward about why they're working. But one of them is that I do believe that I appeal to both women readers and men readers. Mm. And that's a tough trick. I mean, a lot of the thriller writers out there have a strong male audience, and a lot of the fiction-type writers have a strong female audience. So what I do know is that I seem to appeal to both, and that's a big deal. You can capture
Let's do a program on that someday.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Right now, though, let's take a break. We're visiting with John Hart. John is the author of Iron House, his fourth best-selling book, and, you know, I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking with John Hart. John Hart is a friend of ours, a former student at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Now he's known throughout the world as the best-selling author of three successful books, all of them nominated for Edgar's. Two of them received the Edgar Award for the best mystery novel of the year. And now what John Hart believes might be his best book yet, Iron House. And John, the sales figures, Barry, so far, make you think you might have been right about that.
Well, it's early days, as we've discussed, but I mean, this is to if you look, DG, at a lot. I mean, pick any mainstream author that has had success, and if they're flat, flat is the new up. I mean, if their sales are flat, that's the new up, and a lot of authors are trending down. And so, the fact that we're actually up as much as we are compared to the last book is just very exciting.
John, in the last couple of minutes that we got to visit with each other, I want to talk to you about a challenge I think that faces you, and that is in the middle of all of this heady success time with Iron House, how in the world do you prepare yourself for the heavy task of writing another book? How does a successful author who now must attend to all of the things that go with success, like traveling for 6 weeks promoting the book, how does he develop the kinds of experience, life experiences that enriches life enough to make up a new story? And how does he take the time to work on the new book? What are you doing? Are you just going to get rich off this book and move up to Virginia and live on a farm for a while?
Well, no. I mean, I'm always writing. I mean, writers are like everybody else. We have to produce to get paid. You know, the good news is I think that, and I wish I could credit the author that said this, someone admirable, I'm sure, said that, you know, anything worth happening to a writer happens by the time they're 18. And, you know, you can draw on the things that you learned, felt, and experienced in your early life to find a lifetime of stories. And I'm not saying all those stories have to be about young people or children, but just the emotions and the understanding.
So you think you've got enough experience to write books the rest of your life without going out and living anymore?
I mean, I'm certainly not. I haven't stopped living.
No, I mean, going out and, you know, developing new experience. You've got a lifetime of you've got a reservoir of experience that will enable you to write the rest of your life without worrying about going around living in different communities and getting to know people. And
well, I think that the you know, the biggest fear I have, and it may be common, but it's something I deal with every day, is the idea that I'll reach down for the next story and come up empty. So I don't want to sound for an instant like I don't think about that, because I do. I mean, I've burned a lot of bridges and left a lot of careers behind me, and if ever did reach down and come up empty, I don't know what I'd do for a living. What I meant to say, or what my statement really I think is about, is that because all good fiction derives from emotion and from, you know, the internal landscape of the person that's writing, I think all of those things are burned into us by the time we reach adulthood. I mean, there's just something about me, at least. I won't speak for others, but when I dig down for, you know, some sort of emotional response to whatever situation I'm putting on the page, I mean, you know, those responses have been the same and unchanged since I was a young man. So I think that, you know, if it all does spring from some truth that is in all of us, and that sounds hokey, but you know what I mean, if it's all about the universal human experience, that what that quote means really is that we're made who we are at a very early age. So I'm not going to change that much. I could live for another 40 years, and I'm going to be the same guy.
Well, that's great news for all of us, particularly your fans, and so we can look for a fifth book on schedule.
Well, let's not talk schedules yet, but it's coming.
What will you tell us about what's going around in your mind in terms of what you'd like to see from the fifth book?
Well, the book that I'm working on now, I'm very happy with. It's something that I've been kicking around for a while, and I didn't anticipate any doubts or, different thoughts moving forward. But some strange things have happened in that there has been an upswell of sentiment to see a sequel to Iron House. I mean, there are a lot of people that are responding well to this character of Michael. And these are people in the publishing world. They're people in the, you know, the bookstores and at the signings that I meet. That really are responding to this guy.
So this cold-blooded killer, you took him off the page and you made us sympathetic with us, and you made us sympathetic with him so much so that we want another volume, and you're considering giving it to us.
Yes, and the question is, do I stop the one that I'm working on and do that now, or do I finish the current project and then maybe write that book later?
Wow.
And there's a big part of me that's just taking a wait-and-see attitude and see if the book does find a long tail. Does it stay in the forefront for a
this
while,
is
and
so,
that might send one signal.
This is so exciting, and we're out of time. I want to talk about this for the rest of the day, but we're done. John Hart, thank you.
Thanks
for your books. Thanks for your willingness to share with all of us here, and thanks for not forgetting about your friends here in Chapel Hill.
I could never do that, D.G.
And thanks to all of you all for listening. This is D.G. Martin. It's been Who's Talking, and I'll be right back here before you know it.